Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Busy show for you today. We're looking ahead to England's tour of Sri Lanka with the two tests in January. The squad has been announced and we'll look at the permutations available for England for those two test matches after the new year. We're also going to preview an appearance by Joss Butler in our live virtual club on Thursday night. We want you to join that because it's in aid of the Professional Cricketers Trust. We've had some great guests on the live virtual club already, the likes of Joe Root, Stuart Broad, Mark Wood. We had Isha Guha last week. We've had Alistair Cook, Graham Swan. We've had some great guests. And really, Joss Butler tops the lot. He's had an incredible summer, incredible year, an incredible career, actually, with England. He's also looking forward to some busy times in 2021 as well, as part of the squad to go to Sri Lanka. So it's going to be a full-on year for him. And so we can look ahead to that with Joss Butler. So we want you to join us. And you can ask him direct questions on Thursday night at 7 p.m. If you log into worldsbestcricketclub.com, it's £6 a month. But we've got some great guests lined up for you after Christmas as well. The likes of Ian Botham, Andrew Strauss, Alex Stewart, many others, possibly Jofra Archer. You know, we're going to get all the best players on and some really interesting characters. So please sign up to our club, worldsbestcricketclub.com, Joss Butler, this Thursday night, 7 p.m. It should be a real cracker. And also we're going to hear from our last guest, Isha Guha, who was with us last Thursday night, live from Australia. We're going to hear about her difficulties of getting into Australia in the first place as a commentator in the last couple of weeks, having to negotiate the bio bubbles and all sorts of strange restrictions. And we're going to hear her views and her history about getting into broadcasting in the first place. So a really interesting programme lined up for you here. The first bit of it is England's squad for Sri Lanka. What's your take on that, Simon?
Well, in a way, not many surprises, although some quite significant omissions. No Rory Burns. He signalled that fact, actually. He gave an interview to the Standard newspaper last week when he suggested that he may be struggling to make the tour because of the birth of his first child. And of course, it's very difficult. It's such a short tour that if you miss some of it, really, you have to miss all of it. And that is what is going to happen. So Burns is out. And of course, England are resting Jofra Archer and Ben Stokes for very different reasons. Well, perhaps there is some overlap in that they've had a lot of time in the bubbles in the last 6 months. Jofra Archer, he's a bowler they need to look after, I think. England got such a busy schedule. There's another IPL coming up and people say, oh, that's a domestic competition. You should be focusing on playing for England. But, I mean, it's very clear that the England selectors want players to play in the IPL, especially with the World T20 World Cup coming up in India in October, November. So there's that aspect to it. And then Ben Stokes, family bereavement, very sad situation with his father dying. And so he has been given a time off as well. So in a way, not unexpected. and also Johnny Bairstow back in. And that was signalled as well that, you know, Johnny Bairstow got to go away and score some runs. What he has done in white ball cricket, hasn't had a great deal of opportunity in red ball cricket, but he is back in. And, you know, I think we all know that Johnny Bairstow is a, you know, is a quality player. Last time he was in Sri Lanka, he made 100 batting at number three. So those are the sort of the main points, I think. So a new opening pair for England as well, Jose, I would suggest.
Yeah, in fact, it'll be a very different looking top four potentially, won't it, from, you know, the last time they played in the summer. And I think Zach Crawley is earmarked to open with Dom Sibley. So an all right-handed opening pair and very different styles of player. But I'm sure Zach will you know, be able to adapt to that. He has opened for England already, hasn't he, in previous test matches. Mm. And then probably Joe Root at three and Johnny Bairstow at four, or the other way round. And Bairstow will have good memories of that, because it was there at number three, made 100 in Sri Lanka when he was sort of pitched into the team a couple of years ago. So, yeah, interesting. I mean, you know, no shortage of talent for England. It'd be a very big test of Dom Sibley's ability. He's got a slightly unusual technique and won't have faced the level and sort of degree, the intensity of spin bowling before that he's going to be confronted with in Sri Lanka. Two tests in Gaul. We know that pitch spins quite a bit. Actually, I posted something the other day about being able to watch that test match, because of course both these test matches in January will be behind closed doors. But there is that great vantage point at Gaul, isn't there? The fort at the end of behind the sort of sight screen at one end, which is sort of semi-connected to a hotel. So I don't know if anyone could, you know, get a booking in there and then be able to stand on the ramparts and get a kind of grandstand view of the game. You know, you've probably been up there, haven't you?
I have been up there as well, yes. It's a magnificent sight. In terms of going from this country to Sri Lanka, I think that's going to be very difficult. I think you'd have to be living there already if, you know, to go and watch that test series.
What a shame, actually, because it's such a great tour, isn't it, for England fans. You know, Sri Lanka's a wonderful country to go, and it's fairly cheap as well. And, you know, so many different places to go to in between test matches. And it's just a fantastic place to watch cricket. The Barmy Army absolutely love it, so they're going to be really missing it. A couple of other things, I suppose. The opportunity there for Sam Curran, actually, maybe in that series. Not that he's not playing anyway, but he might dovetail, as we sort of talk about spin bowling and the opportunities for spinners. Graham Swan was saying, you know, how important when he first joined Notts, it was to do with partly Ryan Sidebottom bowling at the other end, left arm over, creating rough. So you can see a sort of Dom Bess and maybe a Moeen Ali being able to kind of dovetail with a Sam Curran bowling left arm over the wicket. And he's very similar, of course, to Jaminder Vaz, who was a great successful bowler for Sri Lanka. So opportunity there for him in Archer's absence. And just to see how those spinners develop. Dom Bess with a bowling average at the moment of 40 in Test cricket. Jack Leach slightly better, did pretty well in Sri Lanka the last time. So, you know, all is not completely forlorn for England spinners, but it'll be tough.
Yeah, I expect it will be tough out there. I remember something that Paul Farbrace, the former England assistant coach, said ahead of what we thought was going to be the tour, what, about 10 months ago. And he said last time that England went there, they made the mistake, Sri Lanka, of preparing pitches that really turned square. And so it actually brought England spinners into the game and actually brought the two teams a bit closer together. His feeling was that, you know, perhaps Sri Lanka had a slightly better spin attack. England actually played them pretty well. And this time, what they will do is they will play the long game. So the pitches will actually be quite good for batting, and they'll sort of play a much longer game, so there won't be as much turn. But whether that will be the case this time round, I mean, we've moved 10 months on from that. You know, it all depends on conditions and the ground staff and what sort of pitch they prepare. So it may well be that England play on two quite flattish pitches, and then it's sort of like a test of attrition, or, you know, test of patience, endurance, you know, especially in that sapping heat, that you take the game long, you take it deep into the fifth day and see you can come out on top after five grueling days of Test cricket, rather than have a sort of bang-bang match where the game is over in, you know, 3.5 or just in, you know, 4 days or something like that, with the ball spinning and the spinners sort of licking their lips and having party time out there. So the pitches will be interesting. I think that will be one aspect. And, you know, are the England spinners good enough to hold or bowl Sri Lanka out twice on good batting pitches. I mean, I think that's one of the sort of fascinating aspects of the series to come.
Premium on wicket keeping, of course, as well, with the spinners bowling and the wicketkeeper standing up to the stumps. England have got three wicketkeepers on this short tour of Sri Lanka, with Ben Foulkes included in again, another man who made 100 the last time he was in Sri Lanka. So Ben Foulkes, Joss Butler, who, as I said, we're hearing from on Thursday in the virtual cricket club, and also Bairstow. I guess Butler is the guy in command, the guy in situ at the moment, but actually, there is talk that in the India section of England's winter, when they go to India straight after Sri Lanka for four tests, that Butler may get some time off. And, you know, it's a weird situation, really, isn't it, with these bio bubbles which place so much pressure on players, and they're so sort of chained down to wherever they are. They can't really have a normal life, and so they do need to escape from time to time.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And people have said to me, Jofra Archer, why is he being rested? He hasn't played that much cricket of late. Well, I mean, he did play the IPL. He'd only played the T20s in South Africa before that. There was the English summer, and there was a lot of being in the bubble. And I think, and Joe Root said that on our virtual cricket club a few weeks back. He said that, players will need to sort of come in and out. And I think it's going to be a feature of the year that not everybody can play everything. You wonder whether Root himself actually might have to take some time off just to get that sort of mental break away from the game. And one other thing we should also just flag up as well, or one or two other things actually we should flag up. Dan Lawrence is in the squad. He has been in England squads before. He's been around the squad. He was in the summer. There was talk of him playing the first test match against West Indies, where Joe Root, remember, went away on paternity leave and missed the first test. So, and Ben Stokes captained the side. So he's in there as well. He's in the frame for a place in that middle order, with no Ben Stokes in the side and no Rory Burns in the side as well. And then, what are England going to do about their pace bowling options? It's interesting, actually. You think of spin when you go to Sri Lanka, but England actually got quite a few pace bowling options as well. There's Mark Wood and Ollie Stone, they're two fast bowlers. There's Chris Wokes, and then Jimmy Anderson is there as well, and Stuart Broad. So England have got, and Sam Curran. So England have got six pace bowling options for the tour. So there's a lot to consider, a lot to sort of mix and match before they select their squad for the first test. The other thing is, as well, is they won't have a great deal of preparation time for the start of the test match series. One warm-up game and then into the first and second test matches, and then back home and then off to India for a four-match test series.
Having bowled a little bit myself in Sri Lanka quite a long time ago, but things haven't changed that much, I got one lesson for bowling in Sri Lanka, and that is try to bowl straight and hit them on the pads or hit the stumps, because edges, especially in Gaul, very rarely carry. So if you're trying to get the edge and get people caught slip, you're almost ruling yourself out of taking wickets, actually. You've got to try and get batsmen sort of out of position in some way by maybe bowling some outswingers and getting them across their crease and then trying to pin them LBW. And that's where I think someone like Sam Curran actually might be invaluable. Anyway, talking of bio-bubbles, what was interesting about talking to Isha Guha, our guest in the virtual club on Thursday night, was the fact that it was actually quite difficult getting into Australia and getting sort of acceptance and getting through the protocols in the first place.
In the week build up to actually flying, we still didn't know if we were coming out to Australia. So packed our bags, we were on the way to the airport, got a call from Australia saying visa hadn't been approved, turned around, went back home, had our bags in the living room, and we were sitting around for 3 or 4 days just waiting to see if it was going to happen or not. We were prepared for every eventuality, which was we both weren't going to be able to go. We both were going to be able to come to Australia, or I was going to be able to come and Rich wasn't. So, we are unbelievably thankful. It's been so difficult for even a lot of Australians to get back into their country. So, just to be able to get here was amazing. The actual flight was an experience. You have to wear your mask the whole time. But to be honest, everything was run really smoothly up until the time we got to Australia, whereby it is just potluck as to which hotel you're put in. So at the same time in Perth, Shane Warne was quarantining and Mike Hussey. So I was like messaging them to get advice on what to expect. We heard horror stories on the bus to the hotel about how, you know, at the start of lockdown, people were escaping by tying bed sheets together. So literally from that point on in Perth, no one had a balcony. So we were, again, just preparing ourselves for the fact that there would be no fresh air in the room. You're basically in a room together, not allowed to leave. We handled it okay in the fact that we got into a bit of a routine. I had loads of calls to make back home in the evenings and stuff like that. We did a bit of exercise in the mornings. And me and Rich are never short of things to do. Like, there's always something for us to do. And actually, we're probably the latest ever people to Harry Potter. So we completed Harry Potter in quarantine.
So what was the first thing you did when you came out of those 14 days of lockdown in Perth, just in that hotel?
You're going to love this, Simon.
What was the first thing you did?
So we were desperate for some alcohol. We wanted to be outside and we wanted to be in an environment where we could have a drink. So many people on this call, if they've been to Australia, if they've been to Perth during the Ashes, they would know this spot. It's called the Lucky Shag. It's just on the water there. And the Barmy Army usually set themselves up there. It was a WBBL final at the time. So we wanted to have a bit of cricket in the background. So somewhere that had cricket, some alcohol and some people around. And it was just... it was extraordinary, really. We went down there and it was absolutely heaving. There was no social distancing. Like, everyone was just hanging out like a normal pub scenario. And we were just, in our element, I guess. It just so amazing to see how Australia have coped with everything. It is relatively normal out here. People aren't walking around with masks, you don't have a social distance, but that's purely because everyone that comes in has to quarantine. So we're very fortunate.
We had an email, Simon, that was sent to you actually, but he didn't have your email address, saying a guy who's come out to Australia into Brisbane, and he had a police escort from the airport and straight into the hotel room. They didn't even get given a hotel key because they weren't allowed out of the room. So they stayed in the room for like nearly 10 days, and the only time they're allowed to open the door was to take food in. That's normal.
That's what it is. You base your routine around when you're going to eat, so you get little slots.
We're going to look at your a little bit at your cricket career and a little bit at your broadcasting career. I just like to talk about your bowling initially, actually, because for a start, I looked up the Women's World Cup final 2009, which you played in, and the crowd was 2,300. That's only 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And it was played at North Sydney Oval. So, a nice ground, but not a stadium. And now, the women's game, it's filling up the Melbourne Cricket Ground or Lords, obviously, for the final a couple of years ago. It's amazing how it's changed. But one thing I've always thought about women's cricket is... they're actually, although they're not as powerful as the men, obviously, they have beautiful style and rhythm and balance, a lot of players. It's almost like a throwback, actually, to an old sort of era of men's play where, there's real style and kind of balance and sort of fluidity about it. And I thought that about your bowling action. Really beautiful, sort of Jimmy Anderson sort of rhythm. What do you think?
Thanks, Simon. You're making me blush. I remember being... I don't know, maybe 9, 10, 11 years old, and I used to bowl off the wrong foot, and then all of a sudden it just clicked for me. It just in the middle of the game, because I used to watch the guys on television. I used to go, well, I don't really bowl like that, and then I would try and do it in the nets, and then in the middle of a game, I think I must have been 9 years old at the time, it just clicked for me, and I managed to bowl off the right foot. And then even at the start of my England career, my arms were sort of everywhere. And I really had to kind of work technically on keeping everything a bit more compact and making sure it was, it was a lot more efficient. I guess I used to have quite a whippy action. I used to play a lot of badminton when I was younger. So my shoulder was quite whippy when it came through.
Why did you start playing cricket, Ishan? How did it all begin?
Yeah, classic story, really. Actually, for a lot of the girls, it would probably be something similar. Brother played, he's 7 years older than me, but I guess also my parents coming from India, it was always going to be in the genes, and you know, it would always be on television. Dad would always tell us stories about going to Kolkata and Eden Gardens, and yeah, and from an early age, he would take us to Lourdes as well. So day one of the test, the Lourdes test, he would take us all along as a family. And I was introduced to sport pretty early on. You know, mum and dad wanted me to be involved in lots of different sports. You know, I basically copied everything my brother did: badminton, tennis, hockey, cricket. It was their influence really that allowed me to kind of pursue that dream. I didn't know there was a women's team at all for the first couple of years that I was playing. I started with a boys' team. And yeah, I used to try and kind of chase after the ball when my brother was practicing in the back garden. It was perfect cricket wicket, long fin, greenhouse on the right as I was running into bowl. So a few of those windows got smashed when I was batting because I love the leg side. but again, just classic scenario. Brother would get me out really early and then I'd spend the rest of the evening bowling uphill into the wind.
Yeah. that's the way of it with siblings, isn't it? They want to bat and they want to make you bowl.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I learned how to bowl long spells from an early age.
When did you think you were any good? When did you think, oh, hold on a second, I can play this game. I might be able to make something.
Yeah. So as a kid, you build confidence through your performances, and so I slowly started dropping other sports. So I kept cricket in the summer and badminton in the winter, and I guess being part of a boys team, that really helped with my confidence, because it's pretty obvious you're the only girl. But the other thing was, you know, I've thought about a lot more recently in the last couple of years, is I was encouraged by a lot of people around me. I was the only British Indian within that team of British boys and British Pakistani, and mum and dad never saw that as an issue, and so no one else did. So I felt very comfortable in that environment. And I was successful. You know, I would get wickets. The boys would be afraid of getting out to me. I used to love that feeling. and then dad set up a girls section at the club because there weren't any women's teams really around at the time. He tried to seek out places I could go play. And by the age of 11, I was playing for the under 21 Thames Valley side. So I was already getting these opportunities with older players. And that's when I first met Claire Taylor, who was playing for England at the time. And then I kind of got fast-tracked to playing for the former side, which had three former England players in there already at the age of 12, 13. So they were relatively early experiences for me. But I guess at that stage, that's when I realised that I was kind of mixing it with some of the best players.
And who was your idol? I mean, who did you kind of try and copy the most and sort of really admire?
Again, it'll be similar for a lot of female cricketers my era, because there just wasn't any women's cricket on television. It was always Darren Goff for me, watching England play, the way he used to run in and bowl, his charisma. He always used to make things happen. I mean, he was my idol right up until the time I met him.
And then you went off him. Well, tell him you said that.
No, he's a good friend. Like, I absolutely love Goffey. I love his bubbly personality. Catherine Brunt is a carbon copy of Darren Goff, basically the same personality. But they obviously both come from Barnsley and just have this strong desire to win, but also just bring everyone with them as well. It wasn't necessarily just his ability, it was his charisma, always wanting to make something happen on the field.
Don't tell me you had a picture of him on your bedroom wall.
No, but I was part of the Darren Goff Cricket Academy when I was 13, which got shown on Channel 4, which you might have seen actually, Yoza. But so I would have been 12 or 13 going up to Headingley and being part of all of that. And we got a picture together, and that picture is at home at my parents'.
So the good news is Isha is in Australia now. She's got through the quarantine process. She managed to get there, go through the quarantine. Now she's free. She's in the wild. And she'll be commentating next week on the first test match between India and Australia at the Adelaide Oval. It's a pink ball day-night test match. And Australia have won all those in their own country, so it's clearly going to be a big test for India. They've done well in the warm-up game against Australia A. Well, they have with the ball and belatedly with the bat as well, two low first-inning scores. Where's the balance of power in that series? You feel it's with Australia, although no David Warner. You know, they've got one or two issues at the top of their order. It looks like it's going to be Harris and Burns at the top. Not perhaps the strongest combination for Australia. I think some people would have preferred to have seen, in an ideal world, Warner and Pekowski open at the top. But Pekowski keeps having these problems of getting hit and concussion. I think he's had concussion nine times now. So that, I mean, that is, you know, a serious concern for a top order player, albeit a very talented top order player. Australia's bowling attack, it looks strong. India, you know, they've got potential, of course they have, but can they go into Australia's backyard and turn them over? Well, you can find out. It's on BT Sport starting next Thursday.
And
it's
I'm
on
hosting Five Live.
Excellent. and it's on Five Live Sports Extra as well. So you've got it on the radio and the television. The commentary's coming from ABC in Australia. But ball by ball, if you want to lie in bed and listen to it, or if you want to get up or put your phone on, then you can have Yozza at 4 a.m.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, actually. I mean, not the 4 a.m. bit particularly, but I just love actually watching Australia bowl. I think Hazelwood, Cummins and Stark and Nathan Lyon, they're a superb quartet. And Cummins has had a bit of a rest as well. Hazelwood too, they haven't been playing in the Big Bash. I mean, they just are such good bowlers, and they've just got that kind of desire. They've got that sort of hatred of batsmen, haven't they? And it is compelling watching, and there's some very talented Indian batsmen to confront them, so it should be really good. So Eve Shaguha will be one of that commentary team. And, you know, what we wanted to talk about when we were chatting to her on the virtual club the other night was, you know, what was it like for her coming into broadcasting as a woman in a male-dominated environment? And also, is there any difference between how she's received in Australia compared to England?
So I kind of stumbled into the media, really. I'd done some bits and bobs for Sky and the BBC prior to 2011, but... And this is where Yozza comes in. So I received a message on Twitter, actually, because there was no other way of getting hold of me, obviously, saying, do you want to come in? It'd be great to chat to you about some work. It was with ITV. And I thought, yeah, why not? Sounds fun. Went in. They were hosting the IPL a couple of weeks later on ITV4. I thought, oh, I've done a bit of punditry in the past, so that's probably what they want me for. Went in I was super excited. I was like, yeah, great. And then the boss at the time, Tony Pastor, who I know Simon knows very well, Simon Hughes, just said, oh, well, our normal presenter, she's pregnant and we'd love for you to do it. I obviously was a bit taken aback, never done it before in my life, but did a screen test and just said to myself, I'm just going to embrace it. I'm just going to, you know, it's an opportunity. Let's just have a bit of fun. And so I did a couple of weeks on that. I was horrendous. Yozza will know my early days of presenting on ITV4, where I didn't know which camera to look at. I was unbelievably wooden. But the thing that got me through it all was my cricket knowledge and the ability to ask cricket questions. But myself and Yozza worked on that quite a bit.
I found a bit.
No, I don't want to see a bit. No,
you can just see a little bit of this. Okay, so this is just a little bit from the studio.
With the former Zimbabwe's fast bowler, Pommy Mbangwa.
Welcome back. Before the break, we saw Kings 11 Punjab set a target of 157 in their first innings. This is how Chennai Super Kings got on in reply. That's all from us here in the studio. See you again soon. Just three words from me.
You can take this off now.
Horobo, lorobo, jitbo.
What does that mean?
It means can do, will do, win it.
What do you think?
I cannot watch that.
Well, I'm equally, you know.
That is horrible. So. My voice has changed drastically in that time. So Henry Moran, who's one of our producers at BBC, sent through a clip in the summer of me on radio. Would have been sort of 9 years ago. And my voice is just so different. It's just changed so much. Like it's unrecognizable, actually.
I think your voice is great, actually. I think it's, honestly, I think your voice is fantastic. It's very soothing. It's got more expression now than it used to have, because I think it's because it's confidence, isn't it?
So, you know, so you're saying I used to be monotone
on the sofa 2011, like that clip I just showed. You know, you're nervous. We're all nervous. You know, when you're not, we haven't done it much before. Once you're relaxing into it, you're more natural. There's a word, isn't there? Timbre, T-I-M-B-R-E, which is that sort of tone of voice. And I think you're really good to listen to, actually.
Thanks, Jules. I appreciate that. But it, you know, just back to the question.
It's, back to the question, yeah.
I've never, you know, I've always really appreciated the support I've had in the commentary box and the likes of yourself, Yoza, Simon Mann as well. He's been amazing, you know, you've been amazing on my journey as a radio broadcaster and getting the specifics right and being disciplined as a lead radio broadcaster. And, you know, I think it's like any team, rather than being a female in a male world, it's any team that you join, people are always going to feel threatened and you have to earn their respect. So that's regardless whether you're in a media environment or a playing environment, whatever team you are part of, you have to earn your stripes. And that's what I've always endeavoured to do in any situation that I'm in. And just been very grateful for my opportunities as well. You know, early days, I didn't consider it a career because there just weren't that many opportunities for females. And if anything, it was, you know, what a great experience that I'm getting here. And the plan was always to kind of do the science thing. So to start getting more and more opportunities around the world was fantastic. And then for me, it was a case of, right, I want to learn all the different skills of broadcast, which is, you know, being a lead commentator, a summarizer, TV, radio, reporter, presenter, they're all different skills that you need. And yes, in answer to the question of globally how people respond to females in broadcast, I was actually really surprised. So I spent a lot of time in the UK and India and the Caribbean early days. And then I got an opportunity out in Australia probably five years ago now, working for a radio broadcaster called Triple M, who it was a very laddie station, but I used to listen to them all the time when I was living over here. And I just thought, hang on a sec, I just have no idea how this is going to go down. I'm female, I'm British Asian, who knows how this is going to go? And because it hadn't really happened too much in the past in Australia, and I was very fortunate it went down really well. But I do credit the people around me at the time. So I'm a massive one for your male colleagues or your fellow commentators have the ability to make you look better than what you actually are, just through asking you questions, through talking about you, through having that dynamic where you're having fun in the commentary box, and that comes through the TV screen or in radio. And that's what happened in Australia, and I'm very thankful for that.
Actually, it's a validation in a way, isn't it? And it's particularly the case. I mean, what applies to both of us, Simon and I, and you, is similar in that none of us have played Test cricket, men's Test cricket, and so there is that kind of at times you have to try and earn the people who have played 100 Tests respect. And I actually the kind of key person for me was Richie Beno, who, you know, he just said, look, I'm interested in what you've got to say. I find what you say interesting, stimulating. So you forget then that you haven't got the medals, which some people want to see, you know, and that really helps, I think. Someone of that sort of stature who says, I find what you say interesting is a huge confidence booster, isn't it?
Also, Yoz, Anisha, we're not playing cricket. We're broadcasting. So the people who are playing cricket, they are, that in a strange way, they are in a foreign environment because they're having to do something that, you know, they hasn't been their career. Our career, or my career anyway, you obviously played and Anisha as well. I look at it like this, that in a way they're in my world. And, you know, I've been broadcasting for, you know, 30 odd years. So I sort of feel that I know something about it in a way. So I think I hold on to that. And yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point, actually. You know, if you're sitting next to a former England captain, you know, with 100 test matches, then you are conscious of them thinking, well, what do they know about the game? But actually, what you're doing is you're broadcasting. You're trying to put a broadcast on, which is, so you're not putting a cricket match on. You're putting a broadcast on.
And I think most players who come into the commentary box recognise that. as well. It's so strange seeing, being in the position I am now, and seeing inexperienced former player broadcasters coming in, and seeing how vulnerable they are, in the fact that they don't quite know, you know, where they're looking or when to speak, and that sort of thing, and you have to guide them through that. And I think they do absolutely appreciate that. And you know, in any commentary box that I've been in, there's always been someone there to kind of help me through, and kind of give me advice. But at the end of the day, it is, you've just got to do it to be able to learn and to get the experience. Watching yourself back, listening to yourself back, which is something that I really just didn't want to do for the first 5 years of my career.
I was going to say, it's just actually fascinating watching you, you know, a decade ago, doing the IPL. Everyone who's broadcast will look back 10 years, 20 years, whatever, and think, oh my God, was that me in those days? Everyone will have that moment, you know, and what you hope is that people haven't kept those moments and don't produce them in moments.
Unfortunately,
like
this. In the era, you shouldn't have been born in the era of YouTube, because there's always going to be that stuff knocking around. But I mean, Gary Lineker, when he first started broadcasting, was absolutely terrible. He was wooden. So, you know, he was like this desk. He was that bad. I mean, he was just terrible. But you know, he had so much help, and in the end, he became brilliant. Will Gould has a question for you or two.
My question to you kind of relates back to what has kind of already been said. You do a lot of work broadcasting for both TMS in the UK, and also as of this year, obviously on the TV, and also you do some work for Fox TV, obviously over in Australia. I've watched you over in Australia, and I was just wondering, is there any kind of like differences that you've got to kind of put into fact between broadcasting to an English audience to an Australian audience?
Australia, I would say, is probably a bit more, they use the term banter. And that is just the Australian culture is just to have a bit more fun with it. Don't take yourself too seriously. Yeah, I probably don't think about things as much when I'm here, whereas in the UK, I'm definitely more aware of what I'm saying, because you've got quite a vast audience that you need to work with in the UK, I think. There are a lot of traditionalists out there who want things done in a certain way. So you're always kind of trying to marry up what the best way of broadcasting is, and try and keep everyone happy. So, yeah, I mean, with the BBC TV, we were very keen to kind of move away from a traditional kind of style. But at the same time, wanting to not be too patronising to the current kind of cricket fans, but also just try and bring in the new audience. So that was really fascinating for me in the summer, just trying to get to grips with that.
We got Ian Wigston.
Yeah, go on then. Ian, what's your question?
Good evening, Issa. Good morning, rather. Good to have you with us. When you're doing radio and TV commentary for the same match, how difficult is it to transition between the two? Which for you demands more energy? Do you have separate personas for the two?
Yes, it was very difficult when I first started doing it. There was a Women's World Cup 3 years ago where I was working TV and radio, and literally no breaks in between, and it was very hard to get it right. So television, you've got the pictures there, you're just adding to the pictures, and sometimes when your radio commentary comes in, you're just saying everything that's happening, which you don't need to do. You end up talking too much, actually. These days, if I have to do it, I like to have, you know, a good sort of 20 minutes in between, just so I can get my mindset ready for what I'm about to do. Radio summarizing is probably the easiest of the lot, so really don't need to think about that at all. It just comes really just easily.
Storytelling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just explain the difference, Issa, between summarize, what you mean by summarizing.
Yes, sorry. And... Well, do you want to?
No, you explain can do it.
She just wants to. She wants a drink. She wants a drink of water. Yeah. Or something.
Well, I'll explain. I'll explain it if you want a drink of water.
Yeah.
The commentator in radio, we have a commentator and a summariser. And the commentator, and this would be very obvious to a lot of people, but sometimes we use terms that people, you know, we use jargon that people don't always necessarily understand. But the commentator is the person who on radio does the ball by ball, the nuts and bolts. X bowls to Y, X hits it, two runs, whatever, wherever the ball's gone.
And tell the listener the score, Simon Mann.
And tell the score as well, yeah. And the summariser, what we call the summariser, is the person who analyses it. So I basically, someone like me or Isha, if she's commentating on radio, we say what's happened, and the summariser is the ex-player, whatever, who tells you why it's happened and breaks it down, explains what's going on in the game. And sometimes those lines are a little bit blurred. And Isha, of course, has both summarised as an ex-player and has commentated. Now she is a commentator on radio. You've probably done a little bit of summarising from time to time recently, but you're more a commentator now. And you should also explain, Isha, actually, as well. You talked about lead commentator on TV. A lot of people might think, well, it's just, you know, on TV, I'm not, you know, there are two ex-players on television. You know, is there a lead? Is there a sort of delineation in television as well? So it might be worth just explaining that.
Yeah, there is in television. So similar to radio, the lead commentator tells you what's happened and the summariser comes in and tells you why it's happened. But the lead commentator sometimes gets a bad rap because you're saying exactly what has happened, which everyone can see. So you have to be very careful as to what words you use and how you're adding to the story. And you're basically navigating your way through the session. So you're in the lead chair. You're kind of giving the information, setting up the story and making it exciting for everyone. And then the summariser comes in and kind of gives their thoughts and on why things are happening tactically and so forth. Probably TV now, I can slip into that generally okay. If it's a test match, I'll probably want to have a think about a few things of what I might want to say, who my guest is, who the summariser is. Just to see what I can bring out of them, because that's really important. But I think at the moment, just with where my broadcast is at, I probably have to think about lead radio more than anything. And it's very difficult sometimes because you don't have that time to be able to do it. But yeah, that requires a lot of energy because, you know, you want to make it exciting for people watching. You might want to bring out a story from a guest that you're with. You might want to say your own story about one of the players, and you have to be prepared to do that. And also just where the game is at and how you're describing things. So again, I'll look at different ways of describing something just so it doesn't become too repetitive. Because on a long test day where it's just been, and he's forward in defence and he's blocked that one out and he's not hit that. Do you know what I mean? It can get you can feel like you're saying exactly the same thing all the time. So it's about finding different ways of saying something.
It's actually, I think TV commentary is actually harder than radio commentary, isn't it? Because you're conditioned by the pictures. So first, you can't just go off on a tangent and talk about anything because you're relying on pictures. And secondly, you have to add to the pictures because people can already see what's happened. Whereas on radio, there's a bit more license, Simon, in a way, isn't there?
There is. I mean, I think they're two, they're two disciplines, really. I mean, radio commentary, I mean, it's actually interesting that Isha picked up about the fact that in a test match, the same things happen over and over again. I mean, I remember a test match we commentated on in Abu Dhabi, where Pakistan made 500 and something, and then England made 500 and something on a really, really flat pitch. And it was, there's no one in the ground. A bit like now, actually, with COVID. And you're by about the third day, you're thinking, you know, like, what am I doing with my life, almost? Because the same things are happening over and over again. And that is when, I mean, that is the hardest radio commentary going, I think. So, you know, the spinners are on as well. So you have to, because a wicket could fall, in theory, at any moment, you still have to be on it. You still have to be with the bowler, saying what the bowler's done and what the batsman's done. So, and it can, I think, for the listener, sound quite repetitive. And of course, if you just start talking about a story, tell a story in the middle of a story, the wicket falls, a big moment, then you've lost the moment that you've been almost waiting for an hour. So I think, both things provide different sorts of challenges, actually. And of course, the good thing about TV in that situation, you don't have to say as much when two teams are scoring 500 against each other, especially if you're doing the highlights. But it might be just worth giving people a little bit of insight actually into doing that, how you commentate on the highlights, because last summer the BBC had both live action And, you know, everyone, if you watch the live action, you know what we've heard. But the highlights, you got a whole day's test cricket and it's distilled down into 50 minutes. Now, Isha, are we commentating for all, you know, 6 hours of a test match day when we're doing the highlights, when we know that actually most of it will end on the, to use a metaphor, on the cutting room floor? So how do you do highlights successfully? Because that actually is quite a skill as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that was actually the first time that I'd done it. So the method that I went with was just normal commentary, so I could be in the moment when something happened. And then as the summer wore on, I kind of got used to just commentating for a significant moment. But I also realized that that is different as well in terms of my voice. So almost for highlights, you need to be more excitable because only a small amount is going to go into the highlights clip. And when you're watching a highlight show back, you want it to have energy and not be like it's just come out of a long day's play. So that was something that I picked up from the summer. And yeah, just being prepared that you might not, like, nothing you say might go to air that night because
you all day wasted.
You know, there was a great line. Ian Smith had a great line once. With we were watching a Channel 4 highlights show, and at the end of the show, Ian Smith and Michael Atten were having a beer, and Athers said, "I'm a bit disappointed." He said, "None of my commentary got into the highlights." And Smithy said, "None of your batting ever got into the highlights either." talking of former people on highlights, just quick point actually. But Jeffrey Boycott had this amazing ability to, on a highlight show, to tell us some really long-winded story. You know, it was perfect for him because he could tell his story about Fred Truman for about 20 minutes and occasionally just look over at the play and go, "Oh, that was a rubbish shot," and then back into the story again. And he was actually very good at just kind of almost encapsulating a moment in the play and then almost without drawing breath, carrying on talking, telling us the story. Ian, we cut you off the second part of your question. Give us that one.
The recently mentioned Jeff Boycott was saying earlier this year that women and non-test playing men didn't have the experience to be analysts in the commentary box. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction to that is everyone is entitled to an opinion, but it's the game of cricket. While women haven't necessarily played men's test cricket, men haven't played women's test cricket, so they wouldn't know how that operates. And there are differences there, but there are a lot of similarities around mindset, around, you know, you still have to have a look the first half an hour of the day, get through the first sort of hour of play when the ball's moving around. Before you get to the end of the day, you know, you're looking to obviously not lose any wickets and kind of manage those few overs before the end of play, which can be, you know, quite tricky. Breaking it down into sessions, issues with the ball. As I mentioned, mindset for a batter, for a bowler, you know, there are a lot of similarities there. And so for him to sort of say that's, you can't commentate on something, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I think everyone offers a different perspective, as Simon have said. While they haven't, you know, they don't play men's test cricket, they still offer in different ways in the fact that, well, they're incredible journalists. You know, you trying to set up the story for everyone, you're trying to bring out the debate, you're trying to give people a taste of where the game is at, the context of the situation. And I think you need a range of personalities within a commentary box, not necessarily just playing experience, but personalities, which I think we do really well at Fox, actually. We've got, it feels like a family there because everyone brings their different kind of quirks. And for me, that's what makes a good broadcast, is having the different personalities within a team.
In a way, that point that Isha makes about the different personalities in the commentary box is sort of, it's replicated, it's echoed on the field. I think cricket, especially test cricket, is a conglomeration of different personalities, and that is what makes a team successful, is that, you know, different people are good at different little roles. And so it certainly works for Fox. And I think also that one of the things about commentary, which I think is quite hard if you've been a former player, is there's no benchmark for how you're performing as a commentator. Obviously, when you're a player, you know on a daily basis how well you've done. If you've taken wickets, if you've scored runs, if you've got a duck, if you've been pan all around the park, you know, there's the stats in black and white. But in commentary, you really have no idea. It's all totally subjective. It's all a matter of opinion. Some people like a person's voice, a person's colourful way of describing something, like you, Simon. Some people don't. Some people think, don't like the Bristolian accent, or they don't like the fact that you haven't played 100 tests or whatever. You know, so it needs those variety of voices and attitudes and, approaches to make a radio or TV broadcast the most attractive, the most interesting. And unfortunately, there is no real yardstick about who's doing well or who isn't. I think that's the hardest thing to deal with when you've come from playing to broadcasting. You really got no idea. And actually, you don't get that much feedback either. I suppose you do on social media now, but a lot of it's quite sycophantic.
Or negative. Negative.
Or it can be negative. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you don't get people actually giving you qualitative assessment and saying, well, actually, what that was really good, and you need a bit more of this and a bit less of that. You don't get much of that. Of course, you get loads of it as a player, very little as a commentator.
Yeah, I remember once a former professional footballer as well was doing some training to be a summariser, as a commentator. And he was saying to the person who was doing the training, he said, don't pull your punches. I won't give away the person's name, but he said, to the person who was helping him training, he said, don't pull your punches. They would listen to some of his commentary that he'd done at the weekend. Don't pull your punches. He said, as a player, I was used to my manager telling me I was X, Y, Z, every week, all week, every week throughout my career. So it's interesting, isn't it? Actually, some people just yearn for that sort of feedback, perhaps not in those terms, in that sort of really blunt terms. People like to be, this was good, that wasn't so good. Alistair Cook actually made the point, a very similar point to you were making there in our virtual cricket club a week or so ago, about, he, of course, you think about his stats, they are there. They're there for all time, aren't they? The 12,000 runs, England's record run scorer, 161 test matches, all those consecutive appearances. No one can take that away from him. But when we asked him the question, would you like to have a broadcasting career, or what next? And he said, well, it's in a way, it's sort of up to me, but in a way it's not. It's about the people who employ me, their opinions of me. And you're right, it is very subjective. And actually, that's the other thing as well, is that the audience can like you, but if your boss doesn't like you, or the senior producer or whatever is not so keen, or likes someone else, then that's a problem as well. And what you'd hope is that if lots of people listen to you, then your bosses would like you as well. If you sort of mean, there would be an overlap, but it isn't necessarily always the case. And some people's faces fit and some people's faces don't. And sometimes it can feel, I'm sure, to some people extremely unfair. And it just thinks, well, what do I need to do? And sometimes it's almost nothing. It's just that people don't like you as much as they like someone else. So but you're right. Runs and wickets, catches, whatever, they are in the book. Day in, day out, they are in the book.
I always remember that thing you said actually once about when you're broadcasting, especially radio, and to a lesser extent TV, is to try and broadcast with a smile. Even though people can't see you, they can sort of hear whether you are smiling or not, whether you have a lightness of touch and a fairly kind of positive attitude, rather than a bit of a moany sort of drony voice. And that can definitely help. And I think Isha, in that sense, she laughs. A laugh is always close, actually, to sort of on the edge of her lips. So she's definitely got that bonus, that positive attitude. The one thing I'd say about the Geoffrey Boycott approach, that you sort of shouldn't really be commentating or analysing Test cricket if you haven't played a lot of Tests yourself, I would just say one thing, and that is some Test players, some famous Test players, can't remember much about their career. That was what made them good in a way, is they were in this sort of bubble, they were in this complete zone. And actually, when you ask them about the experience of making 150 against Pakistan in 1984, whatever, they can't remember much about it. So in a way, that sort of character's not much use if there's no real insight. And some people who haven't played the game have studied it in such forensic detail that they've got, a lot of interesting things to say. So there has to be a broad brushstroke here of, it's a broad canvas, really. And it really does welcome all types, provided you've got that enthusiasm and an interest in the first place.
Yeah, you know, as a broadcaster, I think that it's inevitable that some people are going to like you and some people are not going to like you. It's inevitable. And, you know, in these days of social media, the people that don't like you often tend to stick their heads above the parapet and tell you, and you just have to get on with it, really, and believe in yourself and trust yourself. And I suppose if people keep inviting you back for the next game, then you think you must be doing something right. But I really take Isha's point. I think it's a really good one about the sort of variety of views. Yeah, you can have lots of experience. You can, you know, you can play. If you just had people that had played 100 test matches for England or 150 test matches for England, then you would have perhaps you'd have a very samey room. But samey view. But I think,
well, you only have about three commentators. Well,
exactly. And so it'd be actually quite boring. You just sort of have the same view. But equally, you do need that as well. I think you do need that experience. It is great to have that insight. You know, what was it like, you know, when you were 91 not out and it was 25 to win and there were 2 wickets left? And, you know, what was the tension like? How did you try to break it down? You know, we tried to do that, didn't we? With Jack Leach, actually. What was it like to be out there with Ben Stokes when Jack Leach joined us in the Virtual Cricket Club? What was it like to be out there with Ben Stokes, you know, when you were putting on that partnership of 70? And you need that insight because you do get the feel for the game. But also, you know, there are lots of other viewpoints as well. People who've watched an awful lot of cricket, sometimes actually, you know, people who are commentating have actually seen as much, if not more, cricket than the people, you know, who've actually played the game, if you sort of mean, because people watch an enormous amount of cricket over many, many years. You think of someone like, just off the top of my head, someone like, you know, Blowers, for example, would have watched an awful lot of cricket, wouldn't he? That vast experience of watching all types and all sorts of cricket and all sorts of players in all parts of the world as well.
Yeah, well, you can listen back to that Jack Leach comment about what it was like batting with Stokes at Headingley in 2019 on one of our past podcasts. It's about sort of 3 or 4 episodes ago, very neatly edited by Simon Mann. And we hope you like us and you like our tone of voice and our observations on the game. I guess you do, because you're listening to this podcast. And thank you very much for supporting us over the years. And please support us for this final live event of the year with Joss Butler in the Virtual Cricket Club on Thursday night in aid of the Professional Cricketers Trust. As I said, it's £6 to join, but you do get 4 live events for that and the opportunity to ask direct questions to our guest and win signed memorabilia. And we've got some great memorabilia available this Thursday. So go to worldsbestcricketclub.com, sign up, and it really is a worthwhile cause to get involved in, quite apart from the quality of the guests that we've got this Thursday night at 7 p.m. Also, just a thank you to Beer 52, who are supporting this podcast through November and December. Craft beer suppliers, the number one in the UK. We've had lots of great beers from them already over the last few weeks. You can go to beer52.com/cricket and get your 8 free craft beers supplied straight to your door. beer52.com/cricket. 8 free beers, just £5.95. It's a great offer. So hope you can join us on Thursday night for Joss Butler, and thanks very much for listening.
Podcast Network.